This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As public radio listeners, it may not be news for you to hear that Congress is once again contemplating cuts in funds for public radio and television. Last week, the House Appropriations Committee voted to reduce next year's budget for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting by $100 million, or 25%. The CPB provides money to both PBS and to NPR, as well as to local stations and independent producers. The response has been swift and emotional. Grassroots petitions on the Internet, appeals on public radio and TV stations, and an appearance yesterday on Capitol Hill by Clifford the Big Red Dog at the side of Democratic lawmakers who demanded that Congress save educational programs in particular and CPB funding in general. Many who support the cut say their motive is deficit reduction, but this comes amid allegations of political bias in news coverage and new questions about whether government ought to fund public broadcasting at all and whether public broadcasters might be better off. As difficult as the cuts would be, especially for rural stations, it would free public broadcasters from a great deal of political meddling. Others argue that federal support is critical. Who should pay for public broadcasting? Is federal support good for the medium, for taxpayers, for the government? Later in the program, we'll talk with Captain Melinda Morton, the Air Force Academy chaplain who resigned yesterday after speaking out against religious intolerance at the institution. But first, funding political broadcasting. Who do you think should pay for public television and radio? Should the government continue to have a role? Why? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. In the meantime, much is happening politically on this story, and we'll turn to NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik. He's here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good to join you.
As Congress careens toward its summer recess, the House Appropriations Committee is moving ahead. Where does the budget stand for CPB at this point?
Well, it's expected to come before the entire House for a vote later this week. The House Appropriations Committee, as you said, has approved a larger spending package that encompasses a lot of social programs. Public broadcasting is part of that. It cut the proposed budget, which would have been essentially a level budget for public broadcasting, from $400 million to $300 million. That's a 25% cut. And in addition, it actually cut a fair amount of other money for technological conversion that's mandated for television and for certain grants that would have helped children's programming.
That's so, Clifford the Big Red Dog yesterday.
There you go.
Yeah. And now the congressmen pushing for their cuts, is their ultimate goal smaller funding, deficit reduction, or is it to eventually reach zero government funding for public radio and television?
Well, Congressman Ralph Regula, he's an Ohio Republican, was head of the House subcommittee that came up with the spending plan. When I interviewed him, I asked him if there were the concerns of bias and political unfairness that has been leveled against public broadcasting by some critics, including the current chairman of the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. He said that hadn't been brought up by a single member of Congress to him in light of the spending plan. He said, listen, you know, we've got to cut a number of things. The new Medicare prescription drug plan has been expensive. There are the tax cuts. There are the continuing military operations in the Middle East. These are real budget strictures. However, he did add, maybe this is a good time for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to consider other ways to find funding and subsidies.
The House, of course, is not the only voice in this. It will also come up before the Senate. What are the prospects there?
Well, Kenneth Tomlinson, who's the chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and Pat Mitchell, who's the CEO of PBS, both say that they have great confidence that that the money will be restored by the Senate. I've talked to people at NPR. I've talked to people at the Association of Public Television Stations, this large advocacy group for PBS stations. They're much less sanguine about it. They think it's a real source of concern.
And even if the Senate restored it, it would go into a conference between the House and the Senate, and it's hard to tell what would happen there.
That's correct. I mean, in some ways, it's a symbolic fight. It's a lot of money. And at the same time, in the context of the larger spending bill, it's a real pittance. The question in some ways is, this is not the sacred cow it might once have seemed to be after Newt Gingrich and other Republicans in the mid-90s tried to zero out the funding, to eliminate it altogether.
Well, as you mentioned, this argument for the cuts comes at the same time as allegations of political bias in news coverage, unfairness, not balanced. Some people say this is a two-pronged attack. Is there any evidence to support that?
I haven't found any evidence of that. You know, Mr. Tomlinson, in a sense, was offering an implicit bargain, if you think about what he had said. He had been addressing these criticisms, the question of PBS being slanted to the left, the question of NPR being perhaps unfair with its Israeli coverage. I might add he's not the only person who's made those claims, and this is not the first time those have been raised. But he said, I'm in favor of having full funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and public broadcasting world. Help me make sure that that occurs. Help me show that there's a good faith effort to do that. Do some of these other remedies for what he saw was the slanted coverage, and we'll make sure you have your money. So it would seem to go against what he had said for this money to be cut, even as people were addressing some of these remedies he had proposed.
At the same time, I think he also said, gee, we'd hope to keep this this argument within the public broadcasting family, if you will, and now it's become public. Is it any more in his control?
Well, I mean, that's a fair question. Certainly, a number of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has kind of a dual mandate. It's supposed to ensure the independence of the journalism that's done. It's supposed to serve as sort of a firewall from undue political pressure. At the same time, it's supposed to ensure that the journalism done on public broadcasting is balanced and objective. Well, those two things in some points come into conflict. Mr. Tomlinson seems to come down a bit more on the ledger of we're going to ensure that the journalism is balanced and objective. He argues that's the only way. If you convince the Congress, which is led in both houses by the Republican Party, if you can convince Congress of that, why, you're going to have much more luck getting the money that you want and deserve.
And before we let you go, David, what would be the effect if this first round, if that's all it is, if this first round of cuts goes through?
If these cuts were to be enacted into law by both houses of Congress, take NPR stations. The stations get about 15% of their funding from the federal budget, as I understand it. It disproportionately affects stations in less populated areas, that is, rural areas. There are certain kinds of stations geared towards minorities, I understand, in Guam, in American Indian reservations, other places that have a disproportionate level of subsidy from the federal government through the CPB. And it might hit those stations pretty hard. Indirectly, As a lot of this, local stations' money comes back to NPR in the form of payments for programming like this,
like
Morning Edition.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
It would hit the ability of NPR to fund as its coverage the level it now has.
But just to be certain about this, we're not talking about the survival of public radio or public television here.
Not at all.
David Folkenflik, thank you very much.
You bet.
David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent, joined us here in Studio 3A. While Capitol Hill continues to debate how much money the government ought to give to public broadcasting, there are those who say the entire relationship is flawed. Joining us now is Nick Gillespie, editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to talk to you again, Nick.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
Should the federal government continue to fund public broadcasting?
No, I don't think so. And I say that as somebody who's a real supporter of the arts and of alternative media. I'm a member of the alternative media. And I spent a long decade dedicating myself to the study of American literature for very little profit. I think one of the things that we should think about with this is that with government patronage comes government strings, and that it doesn't matter if you were talking about the de Medicis in Renaissance Italy or talking about Pete Domenici, the senator from New Mexico, that this is an insoluble problem, and essentially by allowing government funding for PBS, for NPR, you do give every taxpayer plus every representative in the Congress the right to bash the network and threaten to pull out about 20% of its funding. Congress gives, in fiscal year 2003, according to your website, about 16% of the operating budget for public broadcasting came from the main congressional appropriation. And then there was about that went through CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And then about another 4% came from non-CPB-based stuff. So you're talking about 20% of the budget, which is significant, but I think that could be more than made up through other sources. And more importantly, that would free NPR, it would free PBS from a really pretty stultifying regime of constantly being henpecked.
Reason Magazine espouses libertarian points
That's
of view.
Right.
And one of the consistent arguments of libertarians is also that the government should not subsidize people who compete with commercial broadcasters.
Actually, I wouldn't even put it that way because commercial broadcasters actually get, broadcasters particularly, not cable people, but broadcasters get all sorts of subsidies from the federal government. So it's not really a question of subsidizing unfair competition. It's more a question, I think, I would read it more as a kind of right of freedom of conscience or freedom of religion as much as possible, taxpayers should not be asked to fund things that they don't necessarily believe in. I don't think anybody really believes, no matter how big a fan they are of NPR, PBS, that these programs are of vital national security. As a result, let's get rid of the federal funding or the government funding, and then actually I think we'll have a much more interesting set of networks.
We know you want to get involved in this conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Let's begin with Matthew. Matthew's calling us from Syracuse, New York.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Right along the LA of what you guys are talking about here, I think, first of all, that most people that don't listen to NPR don't really care whether it's funded by the government. But my concern is this: if we don't have some federal government oversight in the form of money, because, you know, it's really the money that talks, what is going to prevent, you know, this whole group here from kind of sliding into the grip of very, very special interests, people that are funding this, you know, through their corporations, you know, in back rooms and things like that, or ultra-progressives that really just want to make this some sort of a mouthpiece for that agenda. And believe me, I just by listening to to NPR for as many years as I have, I think that I've got enough exposure to kind of the way the government works that you know, I definitely am glad that I've found NPR, but I want to keep a balance so that we can, you know, not have it slide either way, because the people in the government, even the people that fund us, they're going to swear about us anyway, and they're going to swear about NPR. But I think we need that oversight to kind of keep the balance that we really need to have.
I think Matthew's points are sort of the focus of the conversation. We'll give you 20 seconds now, Nick. Okay, we'll be back after the break.
One thing is, I wouldn't worry too much about corporate oversight. I mean, it's really, in order to keep an audience, there's going to be a level of balance and there's going to be a spread of perspectives. And that's true even on something like Fox News Channel, where they spice it up a bit. So I wouldn't worry too much about needing government oversight in order to maintain, to keep NPR from going too far left or staying too far centrist.
Matthew, thank you very much for the call. We'll be talking about your question for the remainder of this segment. But we'll be back after a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Capitol Hill, the House of Representatives is considering a budget that would strip away a quarter of next year's funding for public radio and television. Budget politics and accusations of bias play some role in the argument, but there's also the fundamental question, why should government pay for broadcast programming over which they have no say? And is it best for public broadcasters to take money that opens them to political interference? That's the question we're putting to you today. Who should pay for public broadcasting, and why should the federal government continue to play a role? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. Our guest is Nick Gillespie, editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Let's get another caller on the line. This is David. David's with us from Zurich in Switzerland.
Yes, sir. I wanted to say that maybe my comment is just an idea so the Americans can compare more what we have to deal with in Zurich. I pay approximately $12 a month to receive any radio, irregardless of classical or anything. If I wanted to pay for television, I would have a slightly higher charge. This is something that the Swiss just accept, otherwise you don't get it. I have a little bit of a problem with the fact that the government in America is so unreasonable and they can't run a government without having to meddle in a budget that is so pitifully small compared to what it costs for one submarine. But maybe the man from the alternative radio service has a point. It's better to be without the meddling of these conservative people and just have the people pay for the radio themselves. But I'm afraid that in America, we don't have the tradition that we'll accept something like that as the Europeans do.
Yeah, the European model of funding. And I should, Nick Gillespie with Reason Magazine, not Alternative Radio, but go ahead.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that increasingly Americans, at least as far as TV goes, and I think in the near future, radio, are willing to pay. About 85-90% of American households have cable now, so they're actually paying for TV, which even 10 years ago was mostly broadcast and mostly taken for free. So that, you know, that's an interesting shift in cultural mores, I think. The other thing that we might think about is that, you know, the Republican Congress, and I mean, let's be clear, these are cultural conservatives or Republicans who are using this as an attempt to kind of solidify their base or to speak to their base. This is a symbolic issue. Everybody understands that, including people on the left who are upset about this or liberals more generally. In an interesting way, it would conservative Republicans need CPB much more than people, liberals or leftists do. And that's one of the reasons why after Gingrich attacked the idea of public broadcasting throughout the 90s, basically, after the Republicans came to power in 94, government funding for public broadcasting actually rose. And they need it more than you guys do, than your typical listener probably does, mm-hmm. which is an interesting kind of paradox.
I lived in London for 4 years as NPR's European correspondent. And again, a fee system, David, I guess a little bit like they have there in Switzerland, mm-hmm. a license fee, and they had detector vans that would come around and monitor to see if you had an unlicensed television going on in your household. I often wondered how this country would accept detector vans in places like maybe West Virginia or Idaho. Same thing there, David?
Can I make just one last comment?
Yes, go ahead.
I think, you know, that the gentleman says, it's something that is somewhat inevitable, but I would just like to make the comment that I feel it's a pity that we can't somehow coexist without having to have this mixing, which I fear is becoming more and more the mixing of church and state, because it's this moralist attitude that is unfortunately starting to infiltrate our government. And I don't think that we have to compare incidents like Robert Mapplethorpe and Jesse Helms and think that all art and all culture is perverse and used as an excuse to decimate our interest, our fiscal interest in the arts. The arts is our future, and I think we really, as Americans, should invest even a small amount as a spiritual token.
Here, can I just point out something that might assuage some of the people who worry about 20%, say, of the revenues for CPB getting cut if the federal government appropriations go away. In fiscal year 2002, Americans spent $20 billion on arts, entertainment, and recreation. So we're not cheap about spending money on arts and entertainment. In 2002, Americans gave $12.2 billion to charities that support the arts, cultures, and humanities, according to the Statistical Abstract of the United States. So, in fact, there's a lot of money that is being given to organizations that promote the arts, either in terms of buying tickets and whatnot, or actually giving donations. So, one of my arguments about getting rid of public funding for broadcasting would be that it takes away this political sort of Damocles hanging over everybody's head, but it wouldn't mean much in the way of cuts, because I think most of that money, if not all of it or more, would actually be replaced by other forms of giving.
David, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All of this has a history, of course, the funding operations mm-hmm. for public television and radio were not made up. Well, they were made up in 1967, mm-hmm. The creation of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And joining us now is Mike McCauley, an associate professor of communication and journalism at the University of Maine, the author of the book NPR, The Trials and Triumphs of National Public Radio. And he's with us from the studios of Maine Public Broadcasting in Portland, Maine. Good to have you on the program.
Nice to be with you, Neil.
Is it fair to say that the public radio and television system we have today would not look anything like what it is without federal support going back to 1967?
Well, I think that that's true. Before then, there were a really ragtag collection of educational stations. They started way back in the 19-teens. And in fact, before commercial broadcasting took hold in this country, we had about 200-plus educational radio stations. That would be universities, churches, even labor unions that came into being by that time. It was only in the 1920s when commercial broadcasting started coming into vogue that you started seeing another recession in numbers of these stations. And by the 1930s, I think there were something like only 43 non-commercial radio stations. And so gradually over the years, as the non-commercial side suffered neglect, you saw a momentum build for this Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, which was the first federal programming support for the industry.
And in those days, CPB gave a lot of that money, not so much to the stations, but direct to, public television and to NPR as well.
That's correct. I didn't have a chance today to get into the annual reports like I wanted to, but I believe that from about 1970 to 1977, virtually all of NPR's funds were comprised of CPB funds.
And what is the rationale, going back through the history of CPB, NPR, PBS, what is the rationale that government be a partner in this enterprise?
Well, that's interesting. The caller that you had from Zurich a moment ago, I think, was right on in the sense that things have been different here than in Europe. The broadcasters in Europe, BBC included, very much saw their service as something that was going to be a public resource for uplift and education. There's some amount of paternalism in there, but also they had some protections in the sense that there was kids programming, some limits on advertising, and certain quality and diversity standards. That wasn't the case here. The fact that you had public broadcasting formulated the way it was in the 1960s had something to do with the fact that Lyndon Johnson wanted to be remembered as the education president. He knew that there was pressure for better radio and TV in America, and so he was willing to entertain recommendations for a national system. But he made most, if not all, of his money in commercial broadcasting. So the system that passed through Congress and got to his desk in terms of a proposal was not one designed to be strong or strongly competitive to commercial broadcasting.
There have been other serious threats to federal support for public broadcasting in the past. We've made reference to Newt Gingrich's attempt to zero out the budget in 1995. That did not go through. There are those who suspect these cuts may not go through either. But at this point, as you look at it, independently, Mike McCauley, we could say you never worked for NPR. As you look at it, what would be the effect of these cuts on public broadcasting, not just to how they would affect, obviously the budgets of radio and television stations around the country, but how they would affect how they look at themselves?
Oh, boy. I mean, I think there are two things to consider here. First of all, the funding cuts from Congress would have an impact, a negative impact, disproportionately so on small rural stations. But I think the things that are going on at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are also working in another insidious way. I think that when you have a chairperson who has shown a reluctance to defend his own organization and a chairperson of that board that has shown some ties to the White House, as we find out in the last couple of days, you have an erosion within public broadcasting. The champion, the heat shield at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is eroding. So we have pressure from without. We have some pressure from within. And I just fear that there might be a decay of sorts.
Here's an email we got from Anne in Palo Alto, California. On the issue of funding cuts, the PBS stations in large metropolitan areas might be able to raise the money lost in the proposed federal budget, though it's a tall order to increase your fundraising by 20%, as any fundraiser will tell you. Mm-hmm. But I worry about small rural stations, which would not be able to raise the money needed to operate their stations from the local community. I'll bring this up to both of you, but first, Mike McCauley, is this a fair assessment?
I think it's a fair assessment that it would be very tough to make up, especially in the smaller stations, for the revenue that would go away under these proposals. Development people, I'm sure, at NPR and at stations across the country also don't want to see the federal funding go away. It's an important part of the mix. Broadcasters do leverage these funds to good use in terms of attracting other money. And so I think it would be, I don't see how any good could come from it.
And let me raise that with you also, Nick Gillespie of Reason Magazine.
One of the most intriguing proposals to reform public broadcasting in the U.S. comes from the far left, basically people like Gerald Starr and whatnot, who have talked about spinning off the Corporation for Public Broadcasting into a true independent nonprofit that does not get any money from the federal government. I think if the PBS budget, if the NPR budget was zeroed out, which is not going to happen, and I think we can say that with pretty good safety, I think what you might see would be a couple of interesting new nonprofit corporations that would be set up that would accept donations specifically earmarked for rural stations. I think you would see an outpouring of interest in supporting the network, or you wouldn't. And if you don't see it, then maybe it shouldn't be there in the first place. There's no reason to say that everybody living everywhere has a right to have all of the NPR programs beam through a local radio station or on PBS through a local TV station. You might see something like webcasting, which already happens for all of the national NPR programs.
Mike McCauley, I wanted to thank you very much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Mike McCauley, an associate professor of communication and journalism at the University of Maine, and he joined us from the studios of Maine Public Broadcasting Network in Portland, Maine. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Vasu, I hope I'm getting that right, in San Diego.
You are. Thank you, Neil.
Go ahead.
I could not disagree more with Mr. Gillespie. I think that the fundamental reason why public broadcasting exists in this country is the sharing of knowledge, ideas, thoughts, perceptions, both in arts and in news, across the spectrum, liberal, conservative, it doesn't matter. And the role of the federal government, my taxes, your taxes that we are already paying, is to ensure that that broad range of viewpoints, that that broad range of as unbiased a possible presentation of information is critical. He talks about being beholden to the government. If you get your money from another source, you don't think that you're going to be beholden to them? Anybody that you get your money from, there's going to be some level of accountability that is going to take place. But it is the federal government, which is my government and your government, that should guarantee that me and you and Mr. Conservative and Mr. Liberal have a voice in this country and have a voice that they want to hear other than the sensational news that we get everywhere else. It is a fundamental, I think, at this point with the information age, it's a fundamentally important piece of education that adults and younger people have.
Vasu, thank you very much for the phone call.
Good day.
We're talking about the funding for public broadcasting. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now from Capitol Hill is Congressman Edward Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts. He's with us from his office on Capitol Hill. Good to talk with you again, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And this is a discussion that we've been having throughout the programming. Why should the federal government continue to support public radio and television?
Well, public broadcasting costs less than $2 per person per year. It provides, amongst other things, for the children of America from 6 a.m. in the morning until 6 p.m. every night, the highest quality educational and entertainment for children on television, which is available. Generations of young Americans have benefited from it. If there was no such thing as the public broadcasting system, we would have to invent it if it only cost $2 per year per American. So that's the principal reason, from my perspective, that we need to preserve the system.
But isn't there commercial alternatives? Nickelodeon, other broadcasters, the Disney Channel provide that same kind of programming?
They do provide alternative programming. Unfortunately, we have 19% of Americans who do not subscribe to either cable or to satellite. And because of that, we have millions of children living in homes with no access to that programming. And we cannot afford to deny those children, especially in those with incomes of less than $30,000 a year, and that's 10 million of those homes, the educational and informationally nutritious programming that the public broadcasting system provides.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Ed. Ed's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in Oregon, where a few years ago the Oregon State Legislature cut all state funding for public broadcasting.
That states through various institutions and cities, I think, provide something like $600 million to public broadcasting, even now, but not in Oregon. Go ahead, Ed.
Yep. As we're reminded, every pledge drive here in Oregon, just private contributions pay for now two-thirds of Oregon's public broadcasting budget. And, I mean, Oregon public broadcasting still seems to be a very strong public radio and TV station. To the point where, I mean,
so,
you guys are the only thing I listen to all day.
So if they survive the state cuts, you're saying that they should survive the federal cuts all right?
I think between, I mean, just the generosity of people who actually care about it and Well,
we just have a few seconds left with Congressman Markey, so let me just ask him. Congressman, there are a lot of other pressing concerns for the federal government. At this point, maybe money for public broadcasting is dispensable or more dispensable than other things.
Well, children may be only 25% of the population, but they're 100% of our future. It's an extremely heterogeneous population of young people, which we have in America today. Apart from their parents and the schools that they go to, television is the other major factor which shapes the way they view the world. Today, children watch 4 to 7 hours of TV every day. Millions of parents use PBS as the place where they go to ensure that they get a solid mix of educational programming as well. It would be a huge, tragic mistake to
Congressman
destroy
Markey,
something created.
I'm afraid we're out of time. We'll have more on this after the break. Right now we're talking with Nick Gillespie, editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. And Nick, just before the break, we had Congressman Markey from Massachusetts on talking about the central element in his mind of children's programming. And how do you respond to that?
You know, I got to say, it's not surprising that Ed Markey, who coined the term the V-chip, cast this debate in terms of children's welfare. But I really have to say that that's about the most laughable argument or brief for public broadcasting that I can imagine. To suggest that somehow that the real function that people should spend $2 a year on or whatever is so that kids can see Big Bird, or you had mentioned Clifford the Big Red Dog went and petitioned Congress. Clifford the Big Red Dog existed for years before he became a PBS star. I mean, he existed in the marketplace. He was out there. To think that these TV shows would not migrate to broadcast television or to cable television, or that somehow the real function of public broadcasting is to be a babysitter for the nation's children is, I mean, I hesitate to say it, I think it's moronic in the extreme. It's just ridiculous. And if that's what this debate has come to, I think PBS should just pull its funding. It should say, we're not going to take any more federal money. If that's the best argument, that can be leveled forward. There are many other options out there. And certainly, if we're talking about $2 a day for the welfare of children, there's something better that can be done than making sure that Sesame Street is in heavy rotation, especially when Sesame Street is a multi-million dollar organization that has merchandised everything to the max. Get them to pick up the slack.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Bryce. Bryce is calling from San Jose.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is this. In a market that seems to be more and more laden with editorial and less information, I think that NPR provides a great opportunity to provide a greater source of unbiased information. The trick is that I would think that federal funding is appropriate to the extent that NPR can then be responsive to various perspectives that are called for by the by Congress and various segments of the public, and there's been a lot of resistance, it seems, lately from NPR to take a critical look at itself and consider whether it's been unbiased, at least in some respects.
And you think that this is a byproduct of federal support, or what?
No, I'm sorry, I was unclear. What I'm saying is I think that as long as NPR is willing to take a look at itself and be responsive to calls, to questions as to its balance, I think it's much better that NPR be funded by the federal government than, for example, a nonprofit, which, as another caller mentioned earlier, would demand some kind of accountability that would probably wind up swinging public radio one way or another, which is exactly what we want to avoid here, I think.
Thanks very much for the call, Bryce. And I think, Nick Gillespie, what I'm hearing from Bryce and other callers is that, look, there's been this nobody would have invented the funding system for public broadcasting in this country if you sat down with a piece of paper and said, oh, let's do this. But you've got this.
Although on a certain level, that is what happened. The Carnegie Commission that actually created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, we know now, was actually cooked up by LBJ with some design ahead of time. So it's not the accident that people are saying.
I'm not talking about the creation of the corporation, but I'm talking about the funding system, which is partly the corporation and partly listener donations, partly foundations, partly corporations. But it does give you some many legs to stand on. If one leg is pulled out, you've got another leg to stand on. Very different from places like the CBC and the BBC, which when their budget's cut, their budget's cut.
Right.
These have at least other sources of revenue, and that sustaining this balance would be a good idea. And that there's a sense of the entire country owning it if the federal government is
involved. You know, I think we know this. You know, the next time you go to a party where they say, you know, bring your own, but everybody, you know, everybody will share, you realize that if everybody owns something, nobody owns something. I think the fear of NPR veering one way or the other, or PBS veering one way or the other without government support is overstated. The main thing that would keep it tethered somewhere in the middle, or doing actually what it's famous for and what it's well what it's well regarded for, is the audience. If you want to if you want to maintain an audience of a certain size, you're going to have multifaceted shows. You're going to have different people on talking about different things. You're going to have different types of programming. But the idea that that would be objective or balanced or unbiased is also totally misbegotten. The worst journalism in the world is journalism that is objective and balanced. You can't bring passion to that. It doesn't mean that you should be unfair or misrepresent points, but NPR has a definite sensibility, and it is not the same. It's not an objective sensibility, and it might not even be a balanced sensibility. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That's one of the strong points. It's sensibility, and what will keep that sensibility going, regardless of who funds it, is the fact that that's what the audience wants. And the audience always drives the product in media, whether it's nonprofit, for-profit, or somehow government-supported.
Let's get one last caller on. This is Ken. Ken's with us from Summit, New Jersey.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. And talking a little bit before about a couple things. One is that the federal government gives a number of subsidies to commercial broadcasters. And then another point, there was a caller who was talking about how in Europe, there's more of a sense of responsibility to the public by commercial broadcasters. In other words, there's attention to education, there's attention to diversity, those kinds of matters. I mean, the way I understand it, the broadcast spectrum is a public asset. It belongs to all of us. And it seems that that point is lost. And I guess what I'm wondering is, do these commercial broadcasters who bombard us with this nonsense, this profit-seeking nonsense continuously, what do they pay into the public coffers for the privilege of using the airwaves? And surely there should be enough coming back from their profits that would support public broadcast on the very edge of the dial.
Well, I think Ken is talking about another proposal, and, mm-hmm. and we certainly have gotten others, including an email from Chad in Seattle, Washington, saying, how about a check off on your income tax return if you want some money to go to public broadcasting? A lot of alternative sources of proposed for right. funding, and a fee for transferring a license or something like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, the broadcast networks pay a lot of money back to the government in terms of taxes and in terms of licensing fees. They also get a lot of you know, really important and really expensive real estate on the spectrum. I actually think that there is no such thing as the public airwaves. If you think about it at all, that becomes an idea that just folds in on itself. It doesn't make sense logically. But more to the point, think about this: broadcast viewership on TV has been going down to a point where cable audiences are now bigger than broadcast audiences in prime time. That passed a couple years ago. Cable TV is not under the same mandates that broadcast TV, and yet it's drawing more viewers. It's not drawing viewers with bad programming. It's drawing viewers with very diverse programming, niche programming, all sorts of really interesting program. And at the same time, it's the cable industry that funds a lot of public access shows, including C-SPAN. That's not a tax-based program or anything like that. And C-SPAN is a fantastic service. What I would suggest is look at cable as an alternative for great programming, niche programming, very strong programming, and also voluntary programming. Nobody has to pay for it who doesn't want to.
Ken, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I wanted to thank you for your call.
Okay.
And Nick Gillespie, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Nick Gillespie is editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and he joined us here in Studio 3A.